It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Afghanistan says reclusive Taliban chief Mullah Omar is dead. Afghan officials said Wednesday that reclusive Taliban chief Mullah Omar has died. They said he died under suspicious circumstances in a Karachi, Pakistan hospital April 2013. Such reports of his death are nothing new. There has been no Taliban confirmation. White House spokesman Eric Schultz called the report credible, saying it could offer an opportunity for peace.
We do believe the Taliban has an opportunity to make genuine peace with the Afghan government and rebuild their lives in peace in Afghanistan. They can accept the government of Afghanistan's invitation to join a peace process and ultimately become part of the legitimate political system in Afghanistan, or they can choose to continue fighting Afghans and destabilizing their own country.
A second round of peace talks between the Taliban and Kabul set to get underway Friday in Pakistan. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is in Cameroon on an official visit aimed at improving ties and discussing how to deal with the Boko Haram insurgency. Mr. Buhari held talks Wednesday in Yaounde with his Cameroonian counterpart, Paul Biya. Chika Okafor is a Nigerian businessman.
I believe something fruitful will come out of it. Because I trust so much in my new head of state. I believe he's the man of his word, being a former general of the army. And with his counterpart, the president of the Republic of Cameroon, President Paul Biya, who has been a man of his word, he has been a decision man. So I believe both heads of state will find a way out to tackle the insurgents.
The two countries have formed a military coalition with Niger and Chad to combat the insurgents who have pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State. The Nigerian leader, sworn into office in May, has already visited Chad and Niger. This is VOA News. Russia Wednesday vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that would have set up an international criminal court to prosecute those responsible for downing a Malaysian Airlines plane over Ukraine a year ago. Moscow says it wants to wait for completion of an ongoing Dutch-led international investigation. Samantha Powers, the U.S. UN ambassador.
By vetoing this resolution, Russia has tried to deny justice to the 298 victims on that plane and deny their families a chance to hold accountable those responsible. Russia has callously disregarded the public outcry in the grieving nations, the appeals of the families affected. It is tragic that Russia has used the privilege entrusted to it in order to advance international peace and security, in order to frustrate international peace and security.
The aircraft was hit by a surface-to-air missile over eastern Ukraine held by Russian-backed separatists. The president of Somalia Wednesday told VOA his government will not hold popular elections next year due to continuing insecurity. President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed said when they do take place, they'll perhaps take a different shape. He said there is no agreement yet on a format to transition in 2016. A Zimbabwe court Wednesday charged a professional hunter with failing to prevent an American from unlawfully killing a well-known protected 13-year-old lion named Cecil in a case that has drawn international attention. Theo Bronkhorst pleaded not guilty. He faces the possibility of 15 years in prison. His lawyers Givemore move Haringi.
As it is alleged that he failed to prevent an unlawful hunt. We have been to court today and my client has been granted bail in the amount of $1,000. You shall report to the police in Bulawayo 3 times a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And we have also submitted his passport to the clerk of court, Wanenge, and the case is coming up for trial on the 5th of August.
Meanwhile, American dentist Walter Palmer has expressed regret, saying he didn't know the lion was a popular tourist attraction. The story has received a lot of attention on social media. Minnesota police are investigating the death threat against Palmer. In Yemen Wednesday, at least 4 killed when a car bomb exploded outside a mosque in the Shia Houthi rebel-controlled capital Sana'a. An affiliate of the Sunni militant group Islamic State claimed responsibility. Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu gave the go-ahead Wednesday for the immediate construction of hundreds of new housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It drew criticism from the United States. U.S. central bank officials Wednesday said the U.S. economy continued to expand at a moderate pace, despite a slowdown in the energy sector and economic difficulties elsewhere. However, there was no mention of an interest rate hike, which many economists believe will take place in September. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Obama is asked to back up his call for democracy in Africa with some action.
If you are talking about encouraging democracy, encouraging peaceful change of leadership in Africa, then there must be actions that encourage that.
Kizza Besigye is the former leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. Some Burundi opposition and civil society leaders are in Addis Ababa for talks with the African Union. There are calls for the DRC government to reopen a probe into a $3 billion tax fraud. And where is the man who killed Zimbabwe's beloved Cecil the Lion?
I'm not sure exactly where he is at the moment, but he's an American from Minnesota, Minneapolis. It's very difficult to say much about him, but the information we have got so far is that he seems to have committed similar crimes elsewhere.
Emmanuel Fondera is head of the Safari Operators Association of Zimbabwe. Human Rights Watch releases a report today on excessive use of lethal force in Guinea-Conakry. And Kenyan street children want no part in their government's rehabilitation centers. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The former leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change says President Barack Obama's engagement with the political process in Africa is not backed by concrete action. In his speech to the African Union in Addis Ababa, Obama said Africa's democratic progress is at risk from leaders who refuse to step aside when their terms end. Kizza Besigye says if Mr. Obama is serious about encouraging democracy and peaceful change of leadership in Africa, then there must be consequences for those who don't follow that direction and encouragement for those striving to adhere to democratic principles.
Well, actually, nothing new in that regard. Something he has said on previous visits in Ghana and in Cairo. It's not something new that he has said. I think what is most prominent in his engagement with the political processes in Africa is that his words are not backed by any action.
What do you mean action? What sort of action would you like to see?
I mean, if you are talking about encouraging democracy, encouraging peaceful change of leadership in Africa, then there must be actions that encourage that. There must be consequences for those who don't follow that kind of direction. There must be encouragement for those who are striving to bring that to happen in Africa.
Especially term limit, the president mentioned that. And in your country, in Uganda, President Museveni has been in power now for 29 years or so. What's the specification of your constitution on how long the president can stay in power?
Well, as you may be aware, a new constitution was made in Uganda in 1995. And there was unanimous view that there ought to be limits on presidential terms because it is the preponderance of the presidency that has bedeviled the political development, political and eventually the economic development of our country. Unfortunately, it was removed on the very first test it had, because in 2005, President Museveni was completing the second term under that constitution. And unfortunately, he, being the only person in Uganda affected by that provision, did everything to cause its removal from the constitution.
I know you said you are running for the election at 2016. How is your own campaign going?
Well, so far, actually, what is going on is a primary campaign, a process of selecting a candidate from our party, the Forum for Democratic Change, and there are two candidates, the current party leader, Major General Mugisha Muntu, and myself, and the party will soon select one person as the party's flag bearer in the next election. But, you know, we have participated in three presidential elections before. All of them were marred by very serious irregularities, malpractices, and even criminal offenses, people being killed, maimed. There has been a very strong demand throughout the country for fundamental electoral reforms to be undertaken ahead of the next elections. And I am coming into this process, primarily to pursue that demand, to rally the population so that it's not just a demand that remains on paper, but that the whole country can put the force of the people's will behind it, and that we force reforms to be undertaken ahead of the next elections.
Chisa Besigye is the former leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Some Burundian opposition and civil society leaders are in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, for talks with the African Union about the political crisis in their country, where President Pierre Nkurunziza has won a controversial third term. Leading opposition parties boycotted the July 21st poll on grounds a third term violates Burundi's constitution. The East African Community tried but failed to mediate a resolution to the crisis. Innocent Muhozi is general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He says the opposition leaders are in Addis Ababa to probably discuss the idea of the formation of a unity government and eventually the holding of free and fair elections.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of people from opposition in Addis Ababa, those from parties in Bujumbura, but some others who are in exile also. It's more or less 10 parties and civil society members who went in Addis Ababa to have discussions about what they are going to ask for after those elections that they don't recognize.
So what do you think they might want? Do you think they might want inclusion in the current government, or do you think they might want a new election?
It seems like they want a kind of government of transition to organize new elections.
We know there has been some initiative by the East African Community to try to resolve the Burundi situation. By going to Addis Ababa, is this still part of the East African Community, or are these opposition people trying to go over the head of the East African Community?
I don't think that they are going over the East African Community, but they are trying maybe to find a place where they can harmonize their position and to ask a heavy implication of the African Union as well as the one from the East African Community. If I'm not mistaken, some of them were in Kampala having talks with Uganda authorities.
This is coming at a time where that we hear that the CNDD-FDD party of President Pierre Nkurunziza is asking the East African Community to support changing the Burundian constitution. What do you make of that?
I don't know exactly what they ask for to be changed in this constitution, but this attempt to change the constitution, to leave the Arusha Agreement Accord, this is the really heart of the crisis we are living today. So if the government is asking for that, it's clear that the crisis is going to be deepened again.
We know that opposition leader Agathon Rwasa, who has criticized the July 21st presidential election, has taken his seat in parliament. What is the reaction from the other opposition people, including even civil society?
Some of them are disappointed by these decisions, but some others are trying to understand why he did that, because Mr. Agathon Rwasa finds himself at the middle of a kind of crossfire from those who are trying to eliminate his organization. A lot of members of his party are in jail since months. Some others are killed almost every day. Even his wife escaped a killing attempt a few months ago. And today, there's a heavy pressure on Mr. Agathon Rwasa. The other side, there are some other members who were elected on the list of Mr. Agathon Rwasa who maybe want to go have their seats. It was risky for him to refuse to go there. If the others go there, he could lose them. Those are some explanations that could explain why he went there.
Innocent Muhozi is a general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 30th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Democratic Republic of Congo's biggest ever corruption investigation was called off without an official explanation, according to both a Congolese lawmaker and a government spokesman. Investigators were looking into fraud that may have cost the government more than $3 billion. Nick Long has more for VOA.
This was an investigation of alleged corruption over 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, in the customs service of Katanga province in southeastern DRC. Katanga is the source of most of the DRC's mineral exports and a powerhouse for the rest of the economy. Last week, opposition lawmaker Mushizi Kizito called for a judicial inquiry into the alleged corruption to be restarted. Speaking to VOA, he said the investigation was launched in 2013 after Communications Minister Lambert Mende heard accusations about the service.
Je ne sais pas exactement qui a dénoncé quoi, mais il a eu des informations selon les...
Kizito says he does not know who denounced what exactly, but there was information indicating serious corruption and fraud, and Minister Mende sent a letter about this to the Justice Ministry. This led to the state prosecutor sending a team of investigators to Katanga in September 2013. According to Kizito, the team managed in only 10 days to recover some $700 million in unpaid customs and other taxes. But he said the team was then recalled to Kinshasa before it had examined most of the relevant documents for the period. Mende confirmed to VOA that he initiated the investigators' mission to Katanga.
Je ne sais pas s'ils ont récupéré de l'argent. Ils ont identifié, effectivement.
I don't know if they recovered any money, he tells VOA, adding they did identify large amounts of tax owed that had not been paid. But the mission was terminated abruptly, we don't know by whom. Anyway, it would be worth reopening the inquiry, he says. Kizito says the team recovered more than $700 million, but adds that was far less than the estimated total that was owed.
C'est évalué à plus de 3 milliards de dollars, donc comme vous dites, à 3 billion.
It was estimated to be $3 billion, he tells VOA. 279 businesses were implicated, he says, all kinds of businesses, including companies in mining, beverages, services and import-export. $3 billion would have been a hefty proportion of the annual state budget of about $8 billion, Kizito added, and he suggested there might have been fraud on the same scale in the other 10 provinces. He cautioned that some of the estimated $3 billion might have been legal tax avoidance through transfer pricing and other means, rather than illegal tax evasion. But he said this was for prosecutors to establish, and it was a pity the DRC's first ever tax investigation on this scale had not been pursued. As for who called a halt to the investigation in 2013, Kizito, Katende and Minister Mende all said they do not know who was responsible for that decision. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Human Rights Watch released a report today, Thursday, that details excessive uses of lethal force by security forces in Guinea-Conakry during protests in April and May. Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch's Associate Director for Africa, tells Ricky Shryak that despite recent small improvements in security force abuses in Guinea, the ongoing use of force during the political protest is of great concern, especially ahead of the October presidential election.
We document on how numerous occasions the police and the gendarmes used excessive lethal force, but also beat people who posed no apparent threat. While I was interviewing these individuals, 30 of them, they described being slapped and kicked and whipped and clubbed. One young woman had an X cut on her arm. Many of those that I interviewed had physical signs of these abuses that they had suffered, including bruises and broken bones and cuts and hematomas and so on. We were also concerned about acts of criminality that some members of the police and gendarmes engaged in, including the theft of telephones and money and also destruction of boutiques and sewing machines and cell phone call centers and so on. And lastly, I spoke with a number of people who had to pay gendarmes and police, and in a few instances, members of the judiciary, to get out after they had been detained, to the point where a number of people said detention has really become a form of business. So these are unprofessional practices. They should be investigated. Those responsible are held accountable. And then, of course, the hierarchy of the police and gendarmes have to make an effort to address these violations so they don't occur in future.
Your report mentions that certain improvements have been made within the security forces in Guinea compared to past experiences. Can you highlight some of these improvements that you found?
Yes, I've been covering security force response to demonstrations in Guinea for almost 10 years, and I have noted some definite improvements. First of all, it's no longer members of the army and the presidential guard who are responding to demonstrations. It is the police and gendarmes who are legally mandated to do so. Secondly, orders have been given not to use firearms, even though, of course, some are and have been used, obviously manifested in the fact that some have been wounded by bullets. Also, the police hierarchy and the gendarmes try to discipline some members of their forces who have been engaged in excessive use of force and in the lack of neutrality in responding. Also, the police have created a human rights unit within the police force. So these are efforts that are encouraging, but of course there's more work to be done, especially given the very high level of ethnic and political tension in Guinea.
That was Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch's Associate Director for Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Washington, D.C. A Zimbabwean man has been released on bail after being charged with assisting an American who killed one of the country's most beloved lions. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Animal lovers in Zimbabwe and elsewhere are in an uproar over the killing of a 13-year-old lion named Cecil. The lion was known to be friendly to humans and helped bring tourists to Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park. Researchers at Oxford University in Great Britain were using him in a study. But that all came to an end when Cecil was shot dead early this month by a visiting U.S. citizen named Walter Palmer. Zimbabwean authorities have now charged a professional hunter, Theo Bronkhorst, with helping Palmer to kill the popular lion. They say he accepted $55,000 to lure Cecil out of the park, enabling Palmer to first shoot him with a bow and arrow and then finish him off with a gun. Bronkhorst was freed on bail Wednesday after appearing in a courtroom in Hwange, about 700 kilometers west of the capital, Harare. A second Zimbabwean initially accused of helping Palmer, Ernest Ndlovu, was not charged and may appear as a state witness when Bronkhorst goes on trial next week. Emmanuel Fundira, who heads the Safari Operators Association of Zimbabwe, wants to know the whereabouts of Palmer, who has since left the country.
I'm not sure exactly where he is at the moment, but he's an American from Minnesota, Minneapolis. It's very difficult to say much about him, but the information we have got so far is that he seems to have committed similar crimes elsewhere.
Palmer, a dentist from the U.S. state of Minnesota, has since acknowledged killing Cecil, but he said he believed the hunt was legal and the necessary permits had been secured. In Zimbabwe, poaching crimes are rampant and conservation groups say President Robert Mugabe's government needs to step up efforts to combat the poachers. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
3 days before U.S. President Barack Obama visited Nairobi, Kenya, the city announced it was going to relocate street children to rehabilitation centers in the country. The move coincided with a project to clean up the streets before the president's arrival. As Rael Ombuo reports for VOA, many say there must be a better way to address the plight of Nairobi's street families.
Humphrey Mashari is on the streets in downtown Nairobi trying to direct a driver to an empty parking spot. The driver comes out and hands him 20 shillings, about 20 US cents, and Humphrey looks for another client. The 17-year-old is just one of the many street boys trying to survive in the city. He says the reason why he came to the streets is his stepfather was mistreating him, so he left home and started his life over in the streets. Like many on the streets, he has spent time in some government rehabilitation centers designed to give street kids another chance. But for many of the street kids, these centers can feel more like detention camps. He says that's the worst place you can ever go. He says you cannot stay there because boys run away all the time and they wake you up too early. After the White House confirmed U.S. President Barack Obama's visit to Kenya, the Nairobi governor announced that the county government had set aside about 16 hectares of land in Ruai, about 20 kilometers from the center of Nairobi, where it intended to settle city street families. The Kenyan government has budgeted only about $30,000 to fund rehabilitation of street families. Activists like Joyce Mudoni, a former street child herself, says life at the centers is often worse than on the streets. She says the rehabilitation centers are dirty with diseases. And she says when she was 12 years old, her body was swollen when she was there. Some private centers are offering another alternative. Francis Kinyo is a program officer at Undugu Society, an organization that deals with rescue, rehabilitation, and reintegration of street children into society. He says that private rehabilitation centers are more efficient than the government ones. At Undugu Society, they use an approach that is more comfortable for the children.
We rehabilitate them at where they are by giving them life skills on how they can manage the trauma that they have gone through and the issue they have faced in their lives.
Street families in Kenya face a myriad of problems. The government has recognized the need to help, but getting the street families the right kind of help is still a challenge. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority eliminated Sudan's El Ahli Shandi 3-0 in the quarterfinals at the Council of East and Central Africa Football Association's Sekafa Kagame Club Championship in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania on Wednesday. The day's highlight was the all-Tanzania mainland showdown between Young Africans and Azam. Following a scoreless draw at the end of open play, Azam prevailed 5-3 in the ensuing post-match penalty shootout. Kampala City Council Authority and Azam joined Sudan's El Khartoum and Kenya's Gor Mahia in the semifinals. Meanwhile, the Union of European Football Associations, UEFA President Michel Platini, is to contest the FIFA presidential elections. According to the UEFA website, Platini is seeking the support of 209 national football federations affiliated to FIFA. Platini is the fourth to declare his candidature for FIFA's top job. Earlier on, former football greats Diego Maradona of Argentina and Brazil's Arthur Antunes Coimbra, popularly known as Zico, together with the Liberia Football Association president Musa Bility, have declared their intention to contest the FIFA presidential elections. Candidates have until the 26th of October to present their credentials for the elections. The FIFA presidential elections, due on the 26th of February next year, come in the wake of FIFA president Joseph Sepp Blatter announcing on the 2nd of June that he'll step down from office less than a week after being re-elected. Blatter's exit comes in the wake of scandal and corruption allegations that have tarnished FIFA's image. Finally, in volleyball, Cameroon beat Rwanda in three straight sets as Botswana edged Kenya 3-2 in classification matches at the Africa Men's Volleyball Championships in Cairo, Egypt on Wednesday night. Today, Thursday, Algeria play Morocco in the bronze medal playoff. The curtains come down at the tournament in a repeat of the finals 2 years ago. Defending champions Egypt play Tunisia in the final. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The president of Somalia has told VOA that his government will not hold popular elections next year due to continuing insecurity in the country. And that is it for this Thursday, July 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, Africa, have a good Thursday.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guest discussing home-brewed drinks. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.